Oh. Okay, we're up. Here we go. Okay, welcome to listen to Hot Hot Hoops Podcast. I'm your host, Ernest E.J. Christian. Of course, joined here for our weekly pod with the man, Dave Ramil. Dave, what's going on?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's April. Actually, I'm sorry, it's May now. What am I talking about?
May, yeah. Yeah.
And we get to continue the second round of playoff coverage with Miami still in it. So everything's great as far as I'm concerned.
We haven't spoken in a while, actually, you and I. It's been about 2 weeks. I think we last time you and I spoke, it was actually the beginning of the series. I think the series didn't even start yet.
Sure.
And I think I did one more podcast with Dave Hyde from Sun Sentinel.
That's correct.
After that, but beyond that, it's been dead. We're gonna try to fix that. It's the scheduling issues. We're gonna work on it, though, definitely.
In all fairness, you know, it's hard to do, you know, updated content when things change on a daily basis. You know, you're if we had talked after game two, we would have thought the series was gonna be over. If we had talked after game five, we would have thought that the series was over in Charlotte's favor. So, you know, it, depending on when we do the contact, it would have been a very, very different, podcast.
Right. And my feeling exactly too, because after game two, I guess in that Charlotte series, I thought, whoa. And then you add Batum was hurt. Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
sure.
No more than five games. And then all of a sudden, the Charlotte Hornets sweep the two home games, you know, and then they win the game in Miami game five. And I'm thinking, okay, wow, this is great. The blueprint's on the line now. And I wrote a big piece about that before game six. And the blueprint was saved for these 2 days. And then game seven happened. But to be fair, Once they won Game Six, I was confident in Game Seven. Now, what I want to ask you is this, Mr. Ramil, because you went zero dark 30, like LeBron, the last couple games.
That's right.
Why? It's the first round, sir.
I cannot take it. As I told you before, I've realized that I can't control my bias when it comes to watching Miami playoff basketball. You know, I tried very hard over the last couple of years of covering sports to try and remove my bias as much as possible. But there's no denying how passionate I get about Miami Heat basketball. And so when I'm watching those playoff games, they're just too painful for me to watch unless I know what the outcome is going to be. And so you know what? There's an immense gratification to plugging in 3 hours after the game's supposed to have started and checking the score and finding out that Miami came on top. So you know what? I don't mind it. And so I'm going to continue doing this, but only during elimination games. I will watch the first few games of this Toronto series, and then once it starts getting to a point where there might be an elimination taking place, I'll go dark again, and we'll see what happens.
Well, what if Miami is up 3-1 in the series, and they're the ones pushing Toronto to the brink of elimination? You're still going to watch?
Well, no, that's not an elimination for Miami. I'm saying if Miami
is an elimination, okay.
Yes. If the sword of Damocles is hanging over the Miami Heat's head, then I will stop watching the games live.
You know, at least you can confess that. At least you can sit there and say, you know what, I'm a wuss. I can't handle the Heat losing.
I will not confess that I'm a wuss. Those are your words, my friend.
That's my interpretation of the situation. I was so tempted to text in the middle of the game, Game Seven. I don't know if you went dark and turned off your phone.
Oh, I turn off everything. I'm sitting there on the couch like in a meditative state, actually. And then for a while, and after Game Seven, midway through Game Seven, I said, you know what, I can't take it. Too much temptation. I went out for a run, which I never ever do. And I went started running, and by the time I came back, luckily the game was over with, and there I am standing in the middle of my living room, sweating puddles. And I'm going to turn on the phone, and I check my NBA account, and there it is, Miami Heat with a series victory over the Charlotte Hornets. It was perfect.
So basically, I can't get a proper review from you for Game 6 and 7 I wanted to, because you didn't watch those games.
Oh, I watched them after the fact. I just didn't watch them live. Got my NBA TV. I leak pass. I can watch those after the fact, so don't worry about it. I'm caught up now.
Who was your MVP of the Charlotte series?
For the Miami Heat?
Yeah.
I would have to say Luol Deng. I think he was...
Luol Deng! I love hearing that every time.
Yeah, the much maligned Luol Deng, yes. Showing a side that we haven't seen in a long time. But, you know, his incredible scoring, games one and two, without his performance there, who knows what would have happened. But he was phenomenal in those series. We've had other players step up. Hassan Whiteside was very consistent, mm-hmm. both offensively and defensively. Definitely defensively, but somewhat offensively as well. Goran Dragic with a huge Game 7.
Woo!
And I mean, Dwayne Wade's heroics in Game 6. He clearly was a big part of the victory there. But, you know, Joe Johnson played well in spurts. You know, we had big moments from the rookies as well. So I would say it was a great team win, but I think for me, my most valuable player is Luol Deng.
Me too. And it's funny, even with the consistent play of Luol Deng, like, for some reason, his performances go unnoticed. Like, game one, he had 30 points, and yet we're still talking about Whiteside's big performance, you know, double-double debut, playoff debut. And then game six, we're talking about Wade and Dwayne's, you know, fourth-quarter clutch. And don't get me wrong, it was phenomenal. Dwayne Wade went classic throwback on that one. When I might complain about that, but Luol Deng did the carrying the load the entire game. Luol Deng was a guy that got us home, got us at the finish line for Dwayne to close, okay? And it's that gets forgotten. And, you know, Luol Deng was the most consistent player on either team in this series.
You know, he's just been overlooked pretty much his whole career, I think.
Yes.
You know, despite, you know, I remember when I first started reading up on him when Miami acquired him, you know, he was at one point the second most highly touted high school player in the country behind a certain player by the name of LeBron James. You know, he went to Duke. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He went to Duke where he was just part of a system there. And, you know, obviously you're never going to really appreciate a guy from Duke. At least most of the country doesn't. And then, you know, even in Chicago, he was just a defensive stopper, a guy who could score. And there have been inconsistency issues throughout his whole NBA career. He had those last year. A lot of guys wanted him traded. They were hoping he would opt out of his contract. Instead, he's been fairly consistent this year. He's really flourished ever since he stepped into the starting lineup, you know, due to Chris Bosh's injury. And he was huge during this playoff series. So I'm glad to see it. I mean, I've always liked Lou. I've always thought he was a good, solid player and definitely a good person. So you know what? I'm glad he had a big performance.
It took me back also to the statement Pat Riley said, summer 2014 when they signed him after LeBron left, saying that he's one of the most important signings in Heat history. And obviously, you see that at first glance, you think, okay, fine, that's Riley and the Heat being defiant after LeBron leaves. I get that. I totally get that. But if you go with the, you know, me saying the Heat fan thing for a long time. You look at the history of Heat players, you know, that has existed in the 28 years of this franchise. You know, Luol Deng is definitely one of the more, I mean, obviously the sample is small, but if you go based on what we thought he could provide versus what he's done this second half of the season, you know, that's an argument that can be made. I mean, based on his play on the court, his professionalism, and just the fit. He just fits so well wherever he goes.
Well, I think part of the comment was clearly trying to, you know, make a statement in light of LeBron leaving to Cleveland. So you have to kind of pump up the signing. But it also showed, particularly at the time, that Miami wasn't going to accept defeat. 29 other teams probably would have said, you know what, that's it. We're going to throw in the towel. LeBron leaves, and you clearly have to go through a rebuilding phase. You look at what happened in Cleveland between 2010 and 2014. They weren't much of a team. But Miami said, you know what, we're going to take the exact opposite approach. Riley, the guy who said winning is misery, wasn't about to quit anytime soon. So, when he acquired a guy like Luol Deng, it was saying we're still in it to try and win as many games as possible. Last year, absent of the playoffs. This year, here we are making an impact in the second round. So I love it.
Right. And probably the outside Deng, probably the one player I'm so proud of in this series, and I've had to defend him a lot, even early in the year when it was the struggles were real. Goran Dragic, huge in Game 6, and in especially Game 7, but Game 6 also too. Like, he's another guy in that third quarter, you know, when Charlotte was starting to make pushes to come back in the game in Game 6, you know, outside of Deng, of course, it was Dragic who kept the Hornets at bay late in that third quarter, early in the fourth, before Wade did his thing.
Yeah, it was a tough series, you know, I mean, the combination of Kemba Walker and Jeremy Lin, the officiating put some handcuffs on Goran Dragic. The pace of the playing style for Miami limited what Goran could do. So, I mean, there were a lot of different issues there impacting him and negating his ability. I think we've seen it in spurts throughout the course of the season. You know, he was out of shape. He wasn't always in top physical condition. But, you know, he's still capable of big games, and I think that's a huge boost for him moving forward. You know, it was a great performance in Game 7.
And we saw a lot of that, too, also in the second half of the year. You know, once, you know, Bosh went down, of course, and, you know, they changed the kind of style of play, you know, going forward. And once again, I said this on the show, too, way back, that the biggest by doing that, the biggest beneficiary of that change of pace was Goran Dragic, because that's the pace he preferred to play in anyway.
Right. Yeah.
So Game 7, of course, I mean, I know he played well, but I didn't see that. I didn't see the monstrosity of Game 7, the aggressiveness of Game 7, you know, going to the basket with no authority and you know, well, full authority rather, and just doing, you know, the things that made Goran Dragic a third All-NBA team player back 2 years ago. So yeah. great job by Goran Dragic in changing the pace, and he's going to be huge in this series against Toronto. Absolutely. He's going to be huge. also worth noting, this is Eric Spoelstra's first series win without LeBron James. And I remember this yesterday too. This is Dwayne Wade's first series win without LeBron or Shaq.
No, his rookie year. Remember when they advanced past New Orleans?
That's right.
Charlotte, Hornets. They were the Charlotte Hornets at that point. That was right before they became New Orleans, wasn't it?
Okay, right. I'm wrong on that one. But Spoelstra, I'm gonna lay on for a second. I don't see the big deal. People have said. And look, we profess in this podcast that we're a pro Spoelstra podcast. You know, right. I don't get the. You know, it's funny. Like the people who know basketball better than anybody else are the ones saying that he's a great coach. Whether it be coaches, whether it be GMs, whether it be beat writers who follow the game, whether it be guys who analysts who knows the games, versus some stupid fan on Twitter with an egg who says Spoelstra sucks. I like to think that most intelligent people would side with people who know the game of basketball beyond just what they see on TV, right. You know. But to me, I don't know why I'm asking this. But I ask anyway. Is this a monkey off the back situation with Spoelstra? I don't think it really is.
I think not in the more balanced, nuanced perspective that you spoke of. I think people expected Spoelstra to be able to coach his team to that next level. But I think, you know what, I think for those fans that want Spoelstra fired, they're not going to be satisfied no matter what. I don't know why. Either it's because he's living in the shadow of Riley, because he's not the major name of a guy like, you know, I can't think of any other, maybe Greg Popovich or Phil Jackson. Who else in the NBA has achieved as much as Eric Spoelstra has throughout the course of his career? So, I mean, maybe Rick Carlisle, I guess. Doc Rivers, he hasn't even won a finals other than 2008. So you look at what Spoelstra's done, the success he's had. Every coach needs great players in order to help them win. You know, Spoelstra was able to use Dwayne Wade in 2008, 2009. He wasn't able to advance in the playoffs, but he relied on Dwayne Wade at the peak of his career. He used Wade as well as Chris Bosh and LeBron James in order to win finals series in 2012 and 13. And that's just a reality. I mean, Spoelstra needs good players, just like good players need good coaches occasionally. And Spoelstra has proved himself time and time and again. I don't know if it's necessarily a monkey in the back. Like I said, most people understand Spoelstra's impact in the league and what he's been able to accomplish. But for those fans, they're never going to be satisfied anyway. To hell with them. As far as I'm concerned, I don't listen to that crap anymore.
I'll say it again. It won't happen because the Miami Heat are a great organization. They don't do these things. They don't go based on what fans think. They know beyond what goes on behind the scenes.
Right.
You know, but if Eric Spoelstra was ever available, was ever a free agent, said he fired him or he left Miami, he'd be gone within 20 minutes. He'll have offers on the table within 10 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I'd heard, I think, at the start of the season that he was on not necessarily a hot seat, let's say a lukewarm seat. He definitely needed to prove himself, you know, in a post-LeBron era. So I think he's done that. I think he was able to keep this team focused despite the loss of Chris Bosh, the incorporation of new rookie players as well as Joe Johnson and others. And he's steered the team in the right direction. He got past the first round. I don't know if it was necessarily needed for him to win the series against Charlotte in order to keep his job, but it certainly doesn't hurt as far as the critics are concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so
let's move on.
Congrats to Spoelstra on his first series without LeBron. Even though it's not a big deal, he has two rings. That's what I'm just saying. Right. All right, let's get to the matchup: Heat and Raptors, 2-3. Raptors won 3-4 meetings this season. I've been rough on the Raptors this year. Let me back up a little bit. I've been rough. I have said that they're very talented, but to me, it's going to be a hindsight thing with the Raptors for me. Until they actually do something, win a series, you know, I'm not going to go and say, oh, Toronto. And by the way, I picked Toronto to beat Indiana in six. This will be clear.
I don't recall that. I thought you picked the upset.
No, I picked Toronto in six.
I thought part of your whole lack of faith in Toronto was going. I know you had always been somewhat opposed to Toronto being able to advance, even though I was the level-headed one and pointed out to that they did have the ability and the talent this
No,
year.
I put them in the series. I just, you know, I wasn't gonna sit there and put money on that, you know, because I mean, it is just what it is. And I thought I didn't think Indiana would be this competitive in the series, but it is what it was.
There's a lot going on there. Look, we saw it with Charlotte too. I mean, teams that lack that kind of experience that a team like Miami or even Cleveland nowadays, San Antonio clearly, those teams, they don't know how to handle that kind of pressure. Things happen. And as far as Toronto is concerned, there were a lot of ghosts there. I know it's been overstated, it's been beat to death, but there was a lot of pressure for them to be able to advance. Indiana went in there really with nothing to lose, and you know, not much talent other than Paul George. They went in there, punched Toronto in the mouth in game one, and from that point forward, they were always playing very, very difficult. You know, they had to try and find a way to win, and they did. You know, to their credit, they found a way to get the monkey off their back there, and that for me, I think, is very scary because now with the pressure off, they've already achieved something that many people thought they might not be able to, which is get past the first round. Now, will we see a return to the style that led to 50 some victories during the regular season? Are they going to be much more comfortable? Are they going to be playing at ease? I mean, they've still got the home court advantage there. That makes it an extra challenging situation for Miami, in my opinion.
Right. What is the key matchup for you in this Miami Toronto series that you see that can tilt the tables either way?
I think it's a point guard battle, to be honest with you. There are many, as far as when I see the lineups back and forth, there are so many different situations there. I think it's the battle between Kyle Lowry and Goran Dragic. They have a history of being together. You know, they played together in Houston for a while, and they know each other fairly well. Lowry has struggled somewhat in the first round. He's also hurt his elbow. So I think that's part of why it's, you know, his shooting has been somewhat impacted. He's not getting much playing time, or rather, much rest. At this point in the playoffs. And so I think he might be somewhat limited again. But, you know, we need Goran Dragic to be more like the game seven Goran rather than the game five one where he struggled so much. And you know, foul trouble is going to be playing some part of that. But I think he needs to be playing much more confident. That's, you know, Dragic, obviously. And if he can contain Lowry somewhat, that'll be a challenge because, you know, they've got some good shooting there. DeMar DeRozan's going to be an issue. They've got other perimeter players that are going to take. You know, guys like Deng and Winslow and even Joe Johnson, you know, they're going to take their full attention. So for Dragic to be able to stay with Lowry the way he could not stay with Walker in the first round, that'll be for me the matchup to watch.
I'm there with you too. I think that's one of the big matchups. But I think also the one that probably intrigues you the most, though, is the Whiteside Valanciunas Because, and not because Valanciunas is a challenge to Whiteside, but Valanciunas is a very physical player. And
Yes.
Kudos to Whiteside. I mean, obviously, Al Jefferson had his moments in the Charlotte series. He had his moments. You know, the old man game did work. And Whiteside maybe had like a moment or two where he did show some frustration. But he did. It wasn't to the point where he got lost in the series. He still
Right.
found a way to stay active, still found a way to stay productive, and ultimately it paid off in game six and seven. You know,
Yes.
Valanciunas is a little bit different, though. Valanciunas is a guy that will try and get into your head. He's very physical. And I don't know if Toronto is going to feed him the ball early or try to get him in foul trouble, but I do think that they're going to try to get Whiteside off his game early, try to get him in foul trouble. And I think Valanciunas is the kind of guy that can frustrate you to the point where not so much skill wise, but more so just physical play, and you know maybe they get into a little scruff here and there, and then Whiteside can pick up two cheap fouls early in the game, and then next thing you know, White's on the bench, and then there you go, UD's in the game, and Toronto has a size advantage again.
You
So.
know, I wrote about this for the for another site, and I actually broke down the battle, and you're absolutely right. But I think a lot of Valanciunas' physicality is overstated somewhat.
Okay.
I mean, he was challenged by Jan Mahimi, who's had a great season for Indiana, but let's be honest, he's probably not a starting caliber center in the NBA. So even though he had some big moments in the opening round against Indiana, I'm not convinced yet that Valanciunas is the kind of player who can swing a series in Toronto's favor. He might lead Whiteside into some frustration. He might get a little chippy, but I think we've seen, I'd like to hope, a turning point from Whiteside. You know, the conflicting, contrasting styles of Al Jefferson and Cody Zeller for Whiteside to be able to handle those and stay focused within the confines of the game, the context of the game, I think was a huge turning point. I mean, you've got the low post, sorcery of Al Jefferson. You've got the rim running of Cody Zeller. Those are two very different players, and Whiteside had to learn how to defend them all. He didn't always do it perfectly. Like you said, there were moments of frustration, but I think it was a learning lesson for him. I think it's a step forward, and I think he's going to be able to handle what Valanciunas brings. He's still limited physically, I think.
Yeah.
He's strong, he's tough, but he's not as nimble as Jefferson, and he's certainly not as quick or agile as Zeller. And I don't think he's got some nice touch around the basket, but he can be led into a lot of pick and pops, which aren't his strong suit. He's gonna set a screen for Lowry or DeRozan, and then he's going to catch the ball there, and he's going to try and hoist a 15-footer. It's the second, the second most shot that he's taken over the course of the regular season. He takes a lot of layups, and he takes a lot of jump shots, and he's not particularly good. He only hits 39 of those, so 39% of those. So I think it's a matchup that swings in Miami's favor, and I think Whiteside can dominate this.
Yeah, I will still agree. So it's if all things play out regularly and plays out even, that's a Vance Heat right there, obviously. I'm really curious, though, how he approached defending DeMar DeRozan, because DeRozan averaged 30 points a game against the Heat this season. Okay,
right.
He was a nightmare against the Heat. And I know obviously that's Dwayne Wade's matchup, but I don't see Dwayne Wade being the guy that's gonna be guarding him much of the series. I mean, maybe in stretches, but not much, because
right.
You want to obviously save Wade's legs for the end of the game, whatever. But I'm curious, though, early on how they're gonna approach. The matchups. Like, are they going to put Dang on him? Are they going to put Joe Johnson on DeRozan? I've heard some, and I actually kind of tend to, I'm actually intrigued by this, maybe the idea of putting, like, Patrick Patterson, on Wade on Patrick Patterson and maybe giving Dang the assignment for stretches and stuff until they bring in Winslow off the bench and whatnot, Richardson off the bench and whatnot. What do you see in terms of cross matchups with DeRozan? Because I think he's obviously the key guy for Toronto to put him over the top.
I think you're absolutely right. I think Dang probably will switch on to him and limit him somewhat and try and keep him from getting off those quality mid-range shots or getting to the hoop. And I think Wade can stay with Patterson. Patterson's not a huge guy. He's a little bit bigger, more physically imposing than Wade, but he's not really
an
aggressive scorer. Yeah, exactly. He'll stay in the corner. He'll catch it on the wing maybe and hoist up a three-pointer, but he's not going to be able to create his own shot off the dribble. He's not that kind of guy. And Wade still has that speed and the reach where he can limit him from getting a comfortable shot there. So I think the switch there with Wade onto Patterson makes sense if Patterson starts. Now, I mean, Dwayne Casey could switch it up. He could go with Norm Powell, who started off the series against
Indiana. I heard he's hurt, though. Powell's hurt. Not healthy right now. He's not really 100%.
He played in Game 7, so unless he got hurt in practice, I haven't heard anything about it. I'll take a quick look now, but I thought he was active and ready to go.
No, I don't think he's hurt to the point we can't play, but I think they were saying he was nicked up for a little while, so I don't know. Maybe somebody else, I guess I'm thinking about. But whatever. Anyway, but I think that matchup, though, I think the cross matchup is going to be interesting, too. And, you look at Patterson and you think, oh, well, he's too big. Well, yeah, look at the skill sets. I think going putting Wade on Patterson, if that is even thought of by Spoelstra, is a great idea.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think that's the way to go. I think we saw what Lou Alden can do. He guarded a lot of different players. He guarded Kaminsky, who's much bigger. He's guarded small perimeter players. So for him to be able to stay with a guy like DeRozan, who's fairly quick and not necessarily perimeter based. He doesn't hoist a lot of three pointers. He's more about the mid range game, about getting to the line a lot. But that's the issue then. If he draws a lot of fouls on Deng, does Spoelstra feel comfortable bringing Winslow off the bench and putting him on DeRozan? That'll be an interesting matchup, I think.
Very true, very true. Are you convinced now? Like I asked a question about with Spoelstra, and I'm gonna ask about the Toronto Raptors because remember this is the first series win since 2001. This whole idea of the monkey be off the back, because given the way that series played against Indiana, because look, it wasn't easy, and they had chances to put that series away early in the series, even when it went out 0-1. In game one, they bounced back, won the next two games in blowouts. They could have actually put that series away. And look, my thing was with Toronto wasn't during that Indiana series. It wasn't so much the fact that okay, you had to win the series. It's how they looked doing it too. I think, look, I don't put so much stock in style points necessarily, but I thought with Toronto's case, given what we've seen the last couple of years of Toronto failing under the bright lights and whatnot, I thought style points was important. And even to the very end of the series, they almost blew it against Indiana in Game 7. Even to the end, they still look like scared in the moment. You know, do you think that monkey's off their back now? Because I don't. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. I think a little bit of. I think that's the whole thing. Is Indiana was able to go in there and you know, steal that game one in Toronto, and from that point forward, whether they played well or not, the issue then becomes, uh-oh, here we go again. This is a St. Toronto team that can't advance, that doesn't know how to win an opening round series. And that's, you know, that wears on you. You know, there are other things that they probably did wrong on the court, but there are those issues off of it that really start to impact the psyche there. And as far as I'm concerned, I think they were an issue for that Toronto team that hasn't accumulated a lot of playoff experience over the course of their respective careers. So I think that monkey is off their back now. And like I said before, I think now it's an opportunity for Toronto to play a little bit more free, a little bit more openly without the concern. They've already at least accomplished more than most of the teams in franchise history. So for their, you know, from their perspective, anything moving forward is, you know, gravy. It's just an added cherry on top, if you will. And from them, they're just going to be able to play, I think, a little bit more comfortably, a little bit more loosely. And I think it's going to be up to Miami to try and steal a game in Toronto, up to them to be able to say, you know, playoff experience, our playoff experience matters. We're not going to give up home court. We're going to try and steal it from you as well. And this is where the experience, the depth on Miami's team, that's really that's going to play the biggest factor.
All right. Prediction for the series.
Well, you know, I don't do those.
Come on, man.
Please. Hey, man. Hey, Ernest. You know, I'm not going to be put on the line there like that because I don't want to say – I say I feel more comfortable. Strangely enough, I feel more comfortable about Toronto than I did about Charlotte. But I'm not going to go on.
So you're picking the Heat. So you're picking Heat win the series. Heat in six. Thank you. Good job. See, how, that was easy. See, there you go. I got Heat in six. Because yeah. They're not winning in seven games. Is Heat in six.
I've seen Heat in seven too, which is odd because then it's – that's Miami up to, you know, has to go to Toronto for a game
that's
seven.
That's why. That's the reason why I can't say it. And that's why I can't. I'm not saying it can't happen. I'm just saying, though, if the Heat can win the series, they're going to win it in six. Like, yeah. To me, it may be a situation where they, and I think this is something I think we need to discuss here before we move forward, the level of importance for Miami to steal, especially game one, but steal one of these first two games in their Canada Center. How yeah. important it is to win one of the first two and put that seed of doubt in Toronto in the same way Indiana did in that first round series. Now, granted, Indiana, you know, they split the home games, of course, game three and four, but I can see a situation too where Miami steals one and then sweeps the home games three and four, may lose game five, but we'll close it in six in game six. That's how I see it going, to be honest with you.
Well, I won't disagree with you, but I won't agree with you either. At least
not
on the record.
You're playing politically correct. I already told you last podcast, you should run for office. Seriously. You're good at this.
It's not political, man. I just don't want to go out there. I don't want to jinx the team one way or the other. Okay? How about that?
You're too close to this. You're too close to You know, if you were a Heat beat writer, man, oh my God.
I will. Look, if I had to make a prediction, if my job or my career was on the line, I would predict something maybe similar to what you predicted.
Of course you would, because I was correct on that. I know. Heat in six. David Mill, Heat in six. But no, I am standing by my prediction, though. Heat in six. And I like I said, not only am I standing by it, I just gave you the entire layout of the series. Like, if the Heat will win split one of these two in Toronto, they'll sweep the two home games, because I think they're just such a different team at home than on the road. You okay? And then... Yeah. You know, they'll lose game five because it's game five. It's a desperate Raptors team. And then game six, they'll close it out. There you go. And then on to LeBron and the Cavs. Oh, sorry, Hawks. I apologize about that.
You've got the whole playoffs mapped out. Now, you know, Greg Cody had an article today. I didn't read it, but I saw the headline. Okay.
I saw it. No, I didn't read the whole thing, but I saw the headline of it. He has right. Toronto, eh?
Yeah. So he's already giving them billboard material. I don't know how realistic it is. I don't know how much. But Dwayne Casey, you know, after game seven, he said a lot of people had discounted Toronto and didn't think that they'd be able to accomplish an opening round victory. I don't know if that's necessarily the case, considering that they were favored to win the series by most people and they were the second seed in the Eastern Conference. But he doesn't need any extra ammunition, I think. Maybe he'll try to play that. He might try to play that, that underdog card against a team like Miami, which is rare
Yeah.
considering they're the second seed and they're a higher seeded team than Miami. But whatever, we'll see what happens.
Hey, whatever works for you, right? You can create all you want. Michael Jordan was known for that, creating bull material. Like, he
I
would
think
create.
everybody in the league is.
Well, Michael Jordan had a history of creating scenarios in his head to
Yeah.
motivate him.
Perceived slights. That's what
Yeah.
it is. Not real, but perceived slights. It's like, you look at me in a funny way, and next thing I know, it's like, I'm thinking that you hate me and my family, and I'm going to use that to as motivation to beat you down. Yeah.
Last Heat topic here before we go around the league real quick. And it pertains to Chris Bosh. And this is a serious situation because now this Bosh thing with Miami is now national. And now it's a situation where it's now national media. And, you saw a tweet last week or a retweet from Adrian Bosh's wife, hashtag bring Bosh back. And basically, Miami, here's a scenario real quick, pretty much. The situation is this, is that Miami will not clear Bosh, let Bosh play. Bosh has reportedly wants to come back to the team. I mean, especially now with him them playing against his former team, number one. I mean, I'm sure that eats him up alive too, not be able to play. But Miami is not convinced, from what I understand, this is according to Dan Le Batard and other sources. Miami's not convinced that it's the right time for him to play basketball. And every doctor they've checked in with have said that if Bosh plays, it can be catastrophic. Now, the Bosh camp says that he feels fine, no effects and that. But, I gotta be honest with you, personally, I'm not pretending I know the situation because I don't know the situation in its entirety. We're just going based on what we hear from the tea leaves and the media and all that stuff. From what I'm hearing, I have to side Miami on this one in the Heat.
I think, clearly you never want to be responsible for a player putting their lives at risk or any employee or anything like that. So I know that there's a tendency in work stoppages and things like that for the general public to side with owners that are billionaires over players that are millionaire. But I don't think that's the case here. I think Bosch does want to play. Allegedly, he's got a doctor who works for the company that provides the blood clot medicine that Bosch sponsors in TV ads. I can't remember the name now for whatever reason. And apparently that doctor has cleared Bosch to play, but every other doctor that the Miami Heat have met with or heard from say he cannot play, that he's still on blood thinners, that he could either get off of those and perhaps risk his life in playing again, but for now he's definitely not a candidate to play. I don't think it's created any kind of strife there. We've seen Chris on the sidelines. He's supportive of the team. He's flown with the team. He flew to Charlotte for game six. I think that was a big step for him personally, but also to support the team publicly. I don't think that there's any strife there. The way Le Batard made it sound was that there was the potential for some strife there between Bosch, his family, and the team. I don't see that. Again, I'm not as plugged in as Dan Le Batard, obviously, but I don't see it. And I'm hoping that it's just an exaggeration on his part. But I also haven't heard anything specifically from Chris or from the team. They're not going to comment on that situation. They don't think he's qualified or ready to play at this point, and they have to be comfortable in order to give clearance for him to play. It's matter-of-factly. And it makes sense for them to prevent a player from risking his life. And I think that's the bottom line. And I think that's the end, as far as I'm concerned, that's the end of the situation. Accept it. As much as I've talked about it, as much as we've talked about it, and we'd love to see Chris out there, it's not liable to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, I'm with you. And that's kind of the same position I've taken also too in terms of this situation. It's not gonna happen. The Heat are gonna stay firm. And I know they will stay firm on this. They're not gonna allow this to be a liability or they look, people are saying, Bosh come back. No, he's not coming back. This is a life changing situation. This is like I saw Reggie Lewis collapse on the court twice in 93. Later on, and then later on, he died 2 months later after that series at Charlotte. Eric Spoelstra was on the court when Hank Gathers collapsed and passed away. You don't think Spoelstra, more than anybody else, knows the risks in this situation, given that what he went through with Hank Gathers, one of the most well-known athletes at that time, and seeing what happened, and him being on the opposing team and seeing that situation, you don't think that's in the back of his mind? Miami is not going to allow this to happen. Miami is not gonna is not going to allow this to happen. And I think, regardless of, and I'm sure there's other things, why reasons why they won't allow him to do it, but I support the Heat here on 100%, saving Bosh from himself more than anything else. You know, and that's the end game for me. I mean, there's no situation here, period.
Right.
And for the record, I don't think this is a distraction to the teammates, because he's still he traveled with the team the entire. By the way, he was there on the road for games 3 and 4 as well, too. In addition to 6 and 7.
Yeah, I think he specifically traveled with the team on the team flight for game 6. I think that was the big deal there, that he was on a team plane. And so maybe that lends a little bit more credence to the possibility that he'll play because he's already traveling with the team. He's there on the flight or whatever. But didn't happen. Miami
as
was still able
to. As opposed to McGarrison's
private jet. Exactly. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Right. I don't know. I think based on what we know right now, and we'll close it here, the Heat are doing the right thing. That's all. I'll leave it at that. This is my opinion. I'm sure you agree with that as well, too, like you said.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's go. Before we go, we always like to touch around the league. Let's go around the league quickly. Let's touch on these the other three series real quick going on. First off, Oklahoma City and San Antonio tied at 1. Wow. I imagine you saw Saturday's game.
I did.
Spurs beat the living hell out of the Thunder.
I thought OKC was dead.
I thought OKC was in trouble. But I always have this position where allow the team that got blown out or got embarrassed to respond. See, this is the narrative I can't stand in sports now. This is not the NFL. This is not college basketball where one game you're done. No, this is a 7-game series for a reason. We saw this in the Charlotte-Miami series. The first two games, Miami was dominant in the first two games. And what happened? You know, allow the team that lost and got blown out to respond. And what happened? They responded a big way. Now, granted, they almost lost the game last night. I mean,
sure.
But the fact that they went from losing by over 30-something points to literally, and by the way, they controlled the entire game from start to finish, pretty much.
Yes, they did.
So the fact that they responded the way they did, kudos to Billy Donovan and his boys. That was a phenomenal game last night. That ending was crazy, though.
It was. And, you know, from my perspective, though, I've been covering the Thunder. I thought they were just emotionally strained at this point. They were just exhausted because of the stress of, you know, the ongoing, you know, drama regarding Kevin Durant's free agency. You know, Russell Westbrook's, you know, let's say his overactivity at times. I mean, these things are issues. You know, Billy Donovan's first year as a head coach, that can wear on a team. Look, we saw in 2014. You know, Miami faced San Antonio in the finals. That was not the team that we had grown to love or get accustomed to. That was a team that was finally at a breaking point. They were just tired of dealing with the whole injury issues of Dwayne Wade, the LeBron drama, so much going on there that when San Antonio came in there and really, like, again, punched them in the mouth, this team collapsed, the Heat did. And so when I saw that in game 1 from Oklahoma City, I thought it was a very similar pattern playing out there. But you're right, they did turn it around. They were in control of game 2. That ending was insane. I've seen a lot of different breakdowns on it. There were numerous issues from either team. I know the one that gets the most, that has gotten the most publicity is that, you know, Deion Waiters shoved and then shoved Manu Ginobili on the inbound play at the end of the game. And then Ginobili, of course, predictably flopped as a result of the contact. He can't make, you know, have you seen it? Yeah. You've seen it. He put an elbow in Ginobili, which he cannot do. Ginobili, you know, sold the contact like crazy, being Manu Ginobili.
Trying to sell it.
But Ginobili was stepping over the line. So he had already crossed, and he had his arms in out of bounds, and Ginobili did. He was impacting Waiters' ability to throw the ball inbounds because he had his arms on top of over Waiters. So he was committing a foul himself, you know, and he stepped over the line. So he was out of bounds technically on that play as well. So for Waiters to push off like that, again, a foul on both players. Waiters then leapt up into the air to inbound the ball. I mean, that was crazy. That's illegal. Obviously, you couldn't do that. But Kawhi Leonard at the same time was holding Russell Westbrook's jersey so that Westbrook couldn't get free. So that's why he wasn't able to receive Waiters' pass early on. There was just so many things going on there. And then once they finally got the ball inbounds, Danny Green fouled Kevin Durant. Then Serge Ibaka fouled, I think, LaMarcus Aldridge. Then finally, when Steven Adams tried to block Patty Mills' three-point attempt towards the end of the game, a fan holds him back and keeps him from going back into play. Crazy 12 seconds there. So much going on. I think, at that point, you kind of just have to let the officials do what they do and just not call anything, because
Yeah.
you're going to stop it on every other second, and you can't do that. We heard too much about officiating during the Charlotte Hornets series. I don't want to hear about it anymore. I hope it doesn't impact Miami Toronto the way it did Miami and Charlotte. Although I will say that Kemba Walker and Jeremy Lin throwing their head back every time there's some contact on a pick and roll drove me goddamn crazy. I wanted to throw my TV across the room. I'll be honest with you. That was another reason why I went dark. I couldn't take one more throwback head from Jeremy Lin on a pick and roll drive, let me tell you.
Can I say first off, and I know our old comrade, Haley Burns, will actually like this, but I'm a huge Steven Adams fan. Huge
He's
fan. Huge.
phenomenal.
He's awesome. He saved their game yesterday. Did you see him rotate on? Like, first off, the play. Spurs fans can't get mad because first off, the play. Would you prefer the sideline out play, or would you prefer the 3-1 fast break late in the game? I'm taking 3-1 fast break late in the game always. That's easier. So. Because if you guys convert in that play, we're not having this conversation, So Spurs fans can't get that mad. So, because at the end of the day, it still worked out for you in the end, really. You're just going to couldn't execute the play. That said, on that 3-1 fast break, and that entire sequence at the end of the game, Steve Adams rotating the way he did, damn.
He does. Miami Heat Nation would love a guy like
Oh
Adams
my
because he's,
God. He's like
yeah.
Birdman in a lot of ways. In a lot of
Yeah,
ways.
he's I think he's a little bit more tough. He's one of those guys that has a dirty reputation because he does a lot of little things. He grabs arms, he fights for positions, he
Awesome
gets tangled
mustache,
up a
too.
lot.
Awesome mustache.
I mean that's a whole other level right there. But
Yeah.
he's got a really dry wit. I've seen him in the locker room a couple times. He's hilarious. Really, really
I
funny
figure he is,
guy.
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and he's smart. He does a lot of things well. He's got a lot of crap over the course of his career because he was acquired from the draft pick that Oklahoma City got for trading James Harden. So when you look at the two players, James Harden clearly is a superstar or whatever, but Adams is a real solid player moving forward, and he's only 22. He's gonna keep getting better. So his offense is a little limited at this point, but he's already become a very good passer from the high post. He does a lot of good things rebounding. His on-ball defense is great. His rim protection is solid. He's going to be a good player. I don't know if he'll ever be a star, or probably never be a star at the same level as James Harden, but I like Steven Adams for Oklahoma City. I like him, period, to be honest
Yeah,
with
absolutely. And that series time 1-1. Next series also in the West, the Golden State Warriors as against Portland Trailblazers, 1-0 Golden State without Steph Curry. Wow, Steph Curry's played only a game and a half his entire playoff run, and yet the Warriors are 5-1 in the playoffs so far. It's and most of the games have been blowouts. Still,
Yeah.
it's impressive what they're done, what they've done in the series. Now, we heard Steph Curry say with his mouth that he wants to try to play game three. But if the but Dave, here's a question. If the Warriors keep winning, and not only winning, but in the fashion that they've been doing, say they win game two tonight, and then
Right.
say they win game three, say Steph doesn't play game three, but they win game three. They're doing the right thing here by sitting him out, right?
Absolutely. I don't say if you can find a way to win games without Steph Curry, you'd want him at full strength so that you can take on, San Antonio when they meet in the Western Conference Finals. I think that's liable to happen. So you want Curry at full strength, and you're getting an added dimension by starting Sean Livingston. I mean, he's got that length at the point guard position. He plays within the confines of the team. He knows how to run the ball. I mean, he's very, very solid. Undervalued, I think, as a player because of his whole the journeyman experience following his injury. But he's found a great niche in Golden State, and I like him as a player. And Draymond Green has been phenomenal. Klay Thompson is very, very undervalued, but he's a hell of a shooter. He's been a great player.
I think Clay has actually risen his value heavily now these last week and a half.
Right. I mean, look, everybody wants to compare them to the Chicago Bulls and say that style of play in the 90s is why Chicago was a better team. But I mean, why do you have to devalue what Golden State has done this year? They've won 73 games, regardless of what the rules are or what era they're playing in. They've won 73 damn games. That's more than anybody else in NBA damn history. Appreciate their greatness because they are a very,
Thank
very,
you.
very good team.
Thank you. Thank you. I agree with that 100%. And then the other East playoff series kicked off last night. Cavaliers and Hawks. Cavaliers up 1-0. Hawks did fight though in the end. They did put up a fight in the end. I mean, we thought the Cavaliers were. It seemed like Cleveland would run away in the game, and then Hawks put up a little fight in third quarter into the fourth. But, you know, like I said, the Cavs are a better team. They just are a better team. They have the best player in basketball, in my opinion. And that is what it is. What's your thoughts on this series so far?
I didn't know you were such a J.R. Smith fan.
Earl Smith?
I didn't realize when you're talking about the best player of the game, I had no idea you were such a J.R. Smith fan. But no, I think
Deli, Della Vadova.
Yeah. I like Cleveland, and you know, I like their ability to put out Atlanta. I think Atlanta's a very good team, but I think, you know, the same issues that have dogged them for a while, the lack of a superstar, is gonna put them under against this one. They're gonna be able to put up a good solid fight because they have some great players. Kent Bazemore has been able to do some really good work. Horford, you know, obviously, and Paul Millsap. I mean, can you get a more underrated player in the NBA? The guy's, you know, he should be, by all accounts, a superstar. I don't know if there's something wrong with his personality, if he just kind of hides away from the limelight, but he's done everything he possibly could on the court to you know, Heat fans should know all about Millsap because he's been one of those Heat killers for a long, long time, ever since his days in Utah.
Pat Riley should retire his jersey. I'm not even joking around. There are certain guys in Heat history, no matter who they are, it could be anybody. It could be guys who weren't even all stars, but just have a knack for killing the Heat. Whether it's Allen Houston,
ooh,
I mean, obviously Jordan killed the Heat many times. I mean, I've seen Jordan torch Miami, but there are guys who are underwhelming guys who just kill.
Well, I'm going back in the day here, but remember Vernon Maxwell?
Oh, shut up,
Maxwell. He hated Miami because they passed him over in the draft.
One of my all-time favorite games in Heat history was a losing game, and you can actually find it on YouTube. It was 1993. It was a year Houston won a title. And the Heat and Rockets played in overtime. The Rockets at that time, they started the year 14-0. And if I'm not mistaken, I think they were still unbeaten or at least maybe had one or two losses at that point. They were the best team in basketball at that point in the year. Miami with Cyke Lee and Rice and Long and, you know, Steve Smith. And by the way, that was the Heat's first winning season team ever in franchise history. That's the 42-40 team. And they took Houston overtime. Miami controlled that entire game. Okay? And Vernon Maxwell hits a three-pointer to tie the game to go to overtime at the buzzer, but a miraculous three-pointer. Like, literally, like, two guys in his face.
Right.
Yeah. That's why when you said that, you remind me of that game from 1993. It's on YouTube somewhere, too, also. I saw it recently. Yeah, don't remind me of that. Thank you.
Mad Max, he hated Miami. Yes, I don't know why.
He did. He did. And he should have. I mean, if he got past it like that, yeah, he should have.
Well, but again, these, you know, like we talked about before, these are the perceived flights that fuel players. You know, you and I don't have what it takes, unfortunately, not just on a physical level, but you know, maybe emotionally, to be an NBA ball player.
Speak for yourself, bro. I can play ball. I'm just kidding.
All right. I'll see you out there, Ernest. I don't think you. Good luck, man. I hope you give me a direct, you know, interview once you make it to the bigs. All right, that's all I asked for.
I just turned 36 2 days ago. I think my time has passed. I see. You know. Originally, I thought I had the Cavs in six, maybe five. I mean, I think I'm leaning towards five, though.
Yeah, that doesn't seem unreasonable.
The Cavs look like, and I know Detroit played them well in the first round. I know Atlanta, you know, fought at the end. Cleveland's just toying with these teams, though. I think Cleveland is playing its best it's played all year long at this point.
We've seen it before. I mean, we've seen LeBron-led teams before kind of take it easy and only have to turn it up. I mean, and this same team, you know, minus two of their best players in Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving, still gave Golden State a challenge in the finals. So, I mean, you know, this is a very deep, solid
Cleveland team. And here's the thing that people are not even realizing. It's not LeBron dominating these games lately. It's been the Kyries. He's allowing Kyrie and J.R. Smith and Kevin Love to get involved. LeBron will come and when he needs to. He'll be ready for, you know, conference finals, NBA finals. Trust me, he'll be there. You know, but he's building the confidence of his other two stars. And say what you want about LeBron, love him, hate him. This is why he is the most unselfish player since Magic Johnson. This is why he's that good.
Yeah.
These are the things that Miami misses about having LeBron James here. I'm sorry. I know people are pissed that he's gone, but this is the things to make you feel good. That's why you guys are mad.
I think we have to move on before we lose what's left of our listeners.
Hey, we're not live. Fast forward it. All right. Three topics I want to talk about quickly. Luke Walton, new head coach with the Lakers. I'm actually a little shocked. I thought he was staying in Golden State of the Year at least.
And, so am I.
Your thoughts? You like the move? You think Luke? You know, you like the move for? Well, two way question. Do you like the move for Luke, and then for the Lakers?
I do not like the move for Luke. I think, you know, staying in Golden State isn't a bad situation. He's still so young. He still has a chance to gain more experience, to find out more nuances. I think at this point, I don't know whether or not he's ready. We'll never know until he takes over the team, and we'll see how that team advances or is able to grow under his watch. I don't know that the Lakers are necessarily in a position to challenge anybody next season or moving forward. So I know that there's some appeal there because he played there, because he's young, because it is a top coaching gig. You know, it's one of the top teams in the league. I'm a little surprised that they offered to a guy as young and unproven as he is. But, you know, it makes sense on some points and some levels because of the familiarity with the organization. And maybe he can bring in some of the structure that he saw implemented in Golden State. He's, you know, he's played for Phil Jackson, so he's already learned from a number of quality coaches. And we'll see what happens. I am surprised, though. I thought he would have stayed in Golden State. I thought that was a better move for him, was to stay there, keep it under Steve, you know, stay under Steve Kerr, kind of learn what he could from that organization, and then eventually take over another job. I know there's only a certain number of jobs that are available every year and whatnot, but they're going to keep being available, and he's going to continue to be one of those coaches that is sought after. You know, I don't think he's passed up any opportunities. It's not like a guy like David Fizdale, who's never gotten the call and then just chose to stay in Miami. You know, that's the situation with Fizdale. It's completely different. I think Walton he's got some buzz surrounding him, and I think he's going to continue to draw attention from teams in the future had he stayed in Golden State. But if not, I wish him well in Los Angeles.
Agreed. And guess who else disagrees with Luke Walton's decision to go to L.A.? His own father, Bill Walton, Hall of Famer. He disagrees.
Really?
He told, I heard today that his dad was against the idea of him going to L.A. He said that if you're in a good situation, stay in the situation for as long as you can before you decide to go, because the L.A. situation is not really the most stable right now, given obviously the roster is flawed, but also the ownership situation is flawed. So obviously Bill weighed in and disagreed with him also. But, you know, Luke does what he wants. He's an old man. So it's what it is. Yesterday, Stephen A. Smith, ESPN's First Take, said that Kevin Durant would be the best fit for Miami should he become a free agent this summer, which we all expect to happen. He said that Durant is the best fit for Durant moving forward is to come to South Beach. Do you agree with this?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been I've called that all year long. I think that Miami has always had a very legitimate chance. When Washington was tossed out there, when the Lakers were tossed out there, all these other teams, I've thought that Miami, you know, provides the best opportunity. You know, Pat Riley's going to get a meeting with Kevin Durant. You know, he's going to be able to sell him on the structure of South Beach and the organization. You know, there's still quality players there, with or without Chris Bosh moving forward. You know, the ability to take a player like Kevin Durant and put him on a higher stage, that they're going to sell the championship history of Miami, and I think it's going to work. I think it's going to be, you know, I think it's certainly attractive for Kevin Durant. And unless he takes a one-year deal to stay in Oklahoma City, if he moves on from there, I think the top contenders are probably Miami and Boston.
Boston. I keep hearing Boston. You says Boston. Someone else says Boston. I mean, those are dark horses to me. It could be, but it depends on how the roster looks next year, too, for Miami. Because Miami's going to have a lot. I mean, obviously, we'll have pockets on this later on in the summer. There's a lot of situations here.
Okay, when Riley meets with Durant within the first day or two of free agency, if he's able to secure Durant, you don't think every free agent in the world is going to try and sign with Miami? Even an aged Dwayne Wade, Kevin Durant at the peak of his career, you know, he's going to lure whatever free agents are out there. You know, if Luol Deng will take a discount to play here, Hassan Whiteside will take a discount to play here. I think a lot of players will want to stay in Miami because, one, it's Miami, because there's Pat Riley, because of Kevin Durant, et cetera. You know, and the fact that structure is similar to what happened in 2010 is certainly appealing to a lot of players. So I think it would definitely work. Look, players are going to Cleveland to play with LeBron, and it's not like Cleveland's anywhere near the level of a place like Miami.
Right. I will say this real quick. My position on Durant has been the same, and it still remains the same. I think he stays in OKC one more year. Barring any catastrophic situation that happens between now and, you know, June 30th.
Right.
I think he stays in OKC for at least one more year, do another one-on-one. But I think Miami would be a good fit too. I mean, because they have the resources, obviously.
The thing with Oklahoma City is, are they realistically going to be able to get past either San Antonio or Golden State next year? Like, what's the difference between this year and next? And for a player like Durant, for whom the clock is ticking as far as his ability to win a title, I think he wants to go to a situation where he can definitely advance at least to the finals. Miami gives him that opportunity.
I think the only reason why Durant even considers staying in OKC is because of the fact that at least he does another year with the second year option, which he will obviously opt out of again next summer.
It's money,
number one, but also he'll be on the same schedule now with Westbrook and Ibaka.
But maybe he doesn't necessarily want to play with those guys anymore.
Ooh, stirring the pot there, Dave. I see that. Ah, okay. Hey, if because of Miami, look, I'm not going to bitch about it because of Miami. So there you go. I'm okay with it. All right. Last topic here. Quickly on this one. One of my all-time favorite players, Patrick Ewing, has been assistant for a long time. He is now interviewing for the Sacramento Kings job. Yikes! Should he avoid this job at all costs? Could this be a benefit for DeMarcus Cousins?
I think at any opportunity for him to put his name as far as a coaching search is concerned is a good one for him. I know he's been one of those assistants that's never really been offered the job. He's never really been considered as far as that top tier of candidates that are available. So whatever he can do to get there, you know, if he meets with the Sacramento Kings front office and Vlade Divac, et cetera, and he can, you know, sell the fact that he knows how to communicate with a player like DeMarcus, he can see literally eye to eye with a guy like DeMarcus and get him to play at his highest level. I think it works for him. And you know what? Even if he winds up failing miserably, it's still a head coaching gig that's going to pay him millions of dollars. So there's no wrong there as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I'm with you also too. Granted, you see the Kings, you're a little queasy, like, oh, the Kings, oh God, here we go. But then you got DeMarcus Cousins. Maybe Ewing could get to Cousins. You know,
I mean, and how much do you really need to get to Cousins? Cousins is great. You know, he's a very great. Well, he's a very good player.
Oh well, I don't think anybody's doubting that. I think the issue is more so getting him to balance out. You know, the idea of him being less angry, I guess is the word I want to use. Less, you know, volatile,
part of that, and more part of that is Boogie being Boogie. But you know, think about the futility of that organization. I mean, if you played, what is this, his sixth, seventh year in the league now, and he's played for almost six, seven coaches, and none of them have really been able to connect with him other than Mike Malone, and that was when we saw Boogie at his best at the start of last season, and then they went and fired him. That organization has been such a mess for such a long time. I just don't know. I don't know anybody else who has the strength of personality that can reach DeMarcus Cousins like a Patrick Ewing can.
Maybe Patrick Ewing. All right. That's today's podcast. Where can everybody find you, Dave? Oh, by the way, before we go, guys, check out David's new piece on Vice Sports on UD. Udonis Haslam. Excellent piece. I actually gave you a little promo on my social media sites, and people were actually retweeted that when I retweeted for you. So, yeah.
Appreciate that.
Who loves you, buddy? Who loves you?
Well, I mean, I've had the opportunity to interview a few players, and really, it was great talking to Udonis. What a personable guy. I mean, I know it's crazy to think about, you know, because you see him, you know, chomping on the mouthpiece, et cetera, and looking all grim. And there's no doubt about that. He's serious about when he's talking to people, he's serious. But he's also very personable. He's very open. And I talked to him about his career and how he's viewed by the South Florida fans, et cetera. And he was really open and gracious. So that was a highlight for me as far as my ability to cover teams. You know, it's been, I think, the top player that I've talked to. So I really appreciated that. And I'm glad that the pieces came out well and that a lot of people have enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's on vicesports.com. So
yeah, you can click, follow me on Twitter at DRamil13. I've got the piece there. So if you want to, just take a look at that.
And you can follow me on Twitter at EJKersNumber7. Check out my podcast, Earnest Speaking Podcast, on iTunes, Stitcher Radio. A little plug there, of course. Thank you. And my blog also at earnestspeaking.co. courtesy of njscsports.com, and I think we are done here. Go Heats, and hopefully we get that LeBron Wade final conference finals. Hope we get that.
Absolutely.
All righty.